How do our experiences in childhood affect the way that we regulate our emotions, which directly correlate with the happiness we experience and the quality of relationships we have in our life? This is what our special guest, Kim Pollander, and I will be exploring on today's Conscious Success podcast. This is where we teach you how to master your mind, enhance your health, and expand your wealth. Check this out. So I know how much I had to suffer to get to the point where I was open to getting help in my relationships, in life. And I'm grateful to say I finally have what I would call quality relationships, but it's taken a great deal of help from those who understand relationship dynamics. So my first question to you based off of that is, what was it in your life that, what was the catalyst that made you inspired to start learning about relationships and relationship dynamics? And then at some point, I also want to hear what made you want to help others with that as well.
Well, I would say that for most of my life, I come from a start in life of being adopted, given up by my birth mother, and all the classical abandonment issues that result from that, and being driven to a sense of hyper-independence where, unlike you, my starting point was I don't need people and I'm fine on my own and that sort of thing. So it was really experience of experiencing a sense of belonging, acceptance, empathy from people that I never experienced in my life before, where it kind of unlocked something in me or in my heart of, oh, this actually is a need that I have because it feels so good and I don't want to give it up. So maybe I'm not so hyper independent as I thought. And it led me down this, I don't want to say rabbit hole because it was a good hole to go down, but of where it all began. You know, I come from a background of IT engineering, so I'm all about getting to root cause. Where did it all begin? How did I get to where I am today? And why are relationships so difficult? And I love attacking like the biggest problems in life because I'm a problem solver. I'm very left brain oriented. And I believe that whatever problem there is a solution and there is a roadmap. You just have to understand the aspects and the components at play and in order to find the roadmap forward and the solution forward. And so there's no bigger question or problem in life than the romantic relationship and all the triggers and conflict resolution or lack thereof that comes from it.
So it's like utilizing that conditioning of, let's say, cerebral, very analytical, and applying that to, say, understanding arguably the most difficult aspect of life or partnerships, relationships. It was almost as if it enticed you. Like, okay, I haven't solved this problem yet. So how do I do it? And as you were doing it, that's when you realized that maybe the hyper-independence was less of you than you thought it was, or at least you made that trend. Would you say it was that you broke the facade of being hyper-independent, or is it that you, through the knowledge and learning, grew out of the hyper-independence?
I would say grew out of. I believe that all of our initial actions, reactions, reactivity, you know, one of the biggest draws, the biggest points of interest for the work that I do is emotional regulation. And when we talk about reactivity and why can't I control my responses, we're talking about protection mechanisms at play. So if my protection mechanism is hyper-independence, I have a part of me that says, no, no, no. I start getting close to someone and I feel fear that they're going to abandon me. My protection part will step in and say, ah, I don't need you. Or I'll leave you before you leave me. So whatever it is, whether it's anger, whether it's sadness, whether it's emotional dysregulation, as they say, it all comes from a protective place because the number one job of our brain is to survive. Now, the problem with that is that our brain, when it comes to the nervous system and the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex and all the components involved, the number one job of our brain is to survive. And the problem is our brain cannot tell the difference between being attacked by a bear or being criticized unfairly by our spouse. And so what happens is it triggers off this process, this beautiful process that's designed to protect you if you're actually attacked by a bear, designed to protect you. And we respond with protection mechanisms and defenses and all the things to make us survive. At the root of that is what we're talking about here today, a sense of belonging. And how do I belong? How do I be accepted for me and especially all my messy parts?
Interesting. So if I understand you correctly, it's identifying that we have, let's say, safety mechanism, default safety mechanism, type of, we really call it a mask or whatever term you want to give. It's like a way in which we, on an unconscious level, react to life to keep us safe.
Yes.
And therefore, it sounds like that was your curiosity. Like, all right, what is it? Like, what is mine and why is it affecting? And is that what then inspired you to help others with it? Like, once you realized how much you benefited from learning, say, not only that safety mechanism of your own, but also how to regulate your central nervous system, your emotions, et cetera. Was it that at that time that catalyzed you to help others with it? Or did you have a journey that yes. led to that teaching?
For sure. You know, the arc of my life was when I was adopted. I was adopted into a very Christian, conservative Christian family and brought up in those beliefs. And it, to make a long story short, I did not fully accept or resonate with what they were teaching. So in my 20s, I stepped away from religion and all of the God stuff. But there was something in me that still drove to seek things beyond our physical material experiences here on earth. That led me into my first master's, which was spiritual psychology, and the world of energy, Reiki healing, that sort of thing, meditation, the chakra system, and all these things that are beyond, you know, what we can see physically here in this 3D reality. And ultimately, you know, I did end up back in a religious space on a personal level. I won't go deeply into that, but it's just, you know, we seek happiness in life. And what I noticed when I was particularly in that, we'll call it spiritual, but not religious phase of my life, I found that people overall, if you look at my early Christian upbringing, if you look at the spiritual, but not religious phase, if you look at the, okay, there's a religious philosophy that resonates with me now, whatever it is, atheist, people are looking to reduce their pain. And what they're actually doing is they're looking for a sense of belonging. The ultimate, I'd say, the first step to happiness is to understand what your longing is in life. Because if you don't acknowledge what your longing is, then you completely miss the boat on what your deepest needs are. And from my experience, both personally and professionally, I believe that this longing is that everybody has a desire to have everything in, we'll call it their closet of shame, everything in their closet of shame exposed to at least one person on this planet, and have that person accept you, hear you, understand you, despite all the stuff in your closet. And we don't have that experience, at least not in this society in general, unless you really work hard at it. It involves a lot of vulnerability. Now we're back in that fear space. Now the survival mechanism take over, and it's like, no, this is too much. I'm going to go back over here and not need you. So I just think in all my life experiences, I'm 53 now, in my experiences in life, there's just this common thread in life, and that is people are seeking to be heard, to be validated, to be understood and accepted. And whether it's, you know, religion is involved isn't really important. Religion doesn't have to be involved. But that is what I saw as the need that was not getting fixed with just Reiki or just atheism or, you know, agnosticism or whatever your approach to life is. So that was the problem that I wanted to solve is how do you be happy in life?
Interesting. And so you said belonging, which really can only come from relationship and kind of
yes.
as you alluded
Great point.
To, it's
Great
as
point.
You alluded to so eloquently, in order to feel that acceptance, feel seen, feel heard, there's a way in which you have to be one willing to do it and say yes. surpass that safety mechanism that might come up, but simultaneously do it in such a way where the other person, the other party is willing to accept. You know, it sounds like you need two people voluntarily willing to put their safety mechanism aside, or at least try to supersede it temporarily, to create a sense of belonging. And from that sense of belonging, that's what can provide a sense of happiness or like satisfaction, contentment. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what then, what would you say are some of the initial steps in helping to understand what that default mechanism might be? Because if I understood, it sounds like identifying that first, like, what is that wall I put up? Or like, when do I put that wall up? When do I feel the fear or the shame or whatever that, let's say, emotional dysregulation is? Like, what is that? Because then once you understand that, then you can start talking about how to be seen, heard.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So how do you start that process of identifying your tendencies or default mechanism?
Yeah, it involves understanding, you know, you mentioned shame. And that is the heart of it. Mm. You build this wall. What are you protecting? We need to understand what we're protecting and what shame means for you, because what shame means for you is going to be different from what it means for me. And so when it comes to looking at, okay, what is our starting point? What do we need to work on? it's helpful to be able to approach ourselves with compassion. Gabor Mate talks about compassionate curiosity, and that's something that I promote in all my work, whether it's with clients individually or in a group scale with the cohorts that I do online. And that is, we all need to sit with the raw truth of who we are. Most of us cannot get to that place because we construct our sense of self like a house of cards. I don't know if you were a kid and you ever built a house out of cards. It's very, you know, tenuous, like just blowing on it will topple it. And so we build this house of cards where, no, I am a good person. You know, we say a million affirmations like, I am worthy of love. And, you know, the house gets built, but then getting comfortable with feedback is the key to personal growth. What if someone says to you, you know what, Madhu, I think that you're not quite good in this particular area. I don't think you're as friendly as you come
across. How dare you?
And it's important for us to be able to sit with the raw truth of like, okay, I just got some feedback. Tune in, is this true? It might be true in these scenarios. It might be not true in these scenarios. And to be able to sit with both the good and the bad of ourselves. Because if you are unable to do that, you are prime for manipulation. Because I can come to you and say, Madhu, you are the best podcast host on the planet. I'm blown away. I don't want to go on another. You've ruined me for all podcasts in the future. And
we're just going to quit that.
And you say, oh, yeah. Yeah. I, you know, without tuning into like, well, I'm good, but I don't know if I'm the best. Now you're ripe to like whatever I want to get out of you. And so being able to sit with feedback will be easier if we can approach ourselves with compassionate curiosity. There is a method to our madness. None of us want to be angry as a response or want to be, you know, like super critical. And so we need to understand what are these protective responses that we have, understand why they're there. And the advanced version is appreciate how they got us through them. There's some really hard years.
So there's a way in which you have to weigh in the things that feel good and sound good, the things that maybe don't feel so good, sound good, and actually take what, I mean, as I don't like to oversimplify with this term, but it's like a logical aerial view of what the reality is. And in order to be self-accepting, you have to not just accept all the bad things about you and wallow it, not accept just the good things and, you know, create a facade around that, but rather be willing to look at and acknowledge that. And one of the best ways to do that is surrounding yourself by those who can actually give compassionate feedback.
Yes.
And then from that space of compassionate feedback and self-introspection, then one can actually develop, like you said, appreciation, gratitude. It creates, let's say, a breeding ground for that gratitude or appreciation to manifest, to see, yeah, that it's actually ultimately good. I mean, I don't like the word good. It's like, it is. Like, yes. This is just what the situation is, and this is what to work on. This needs more work or less work. Is that?
Yeah. And I'll give you an example to highlight how compassionate curiosity can completely change the conversation. So as I said, abandonment issues, I've had anger issues my whole life, really struggled with that especially in my 20s and part of my 30s, and led to drinking. I was a big drinker, loved to drink excessively. So someone can come up to me and say, wow, Kim, like you're a blackout drinker, you're an alcoholic. What is wrong with you? Like, get your act together. You know, and why are you so angry? Like, what's going on? Now, that has the potential to really spiral me into shame, to say, like, oh, I don't need you. I'll leave you before you leave me. All the abandonment stuff kicks in. I don't need you. And I'm over here now. No introspection, no personal growth. And now I'm still, you know, waking up from a night of drinking and nothing has improved. If someone instead were to say to me, hey, I understand why you drink so much, because you have a lot of pain. What does drinking give you? It gives you a sense of relief. It makes the pain go away just for a few hours. And who wouldn't want to relieve that pain? Who wouldn't want to? If you have something right there that's tangible that you can do, and it's like a pill that can numb you out from all the heartache in the world. And this anger thing, understanding that anger is very protective when you've lived a life where no one advocated for you or your feelings. And anger became this best friend that really stepped in and made you feel like you weren't weak and pathetic, but that you were strong and empowered. I could see why you would choose anger. For whatever behavior we want to give up, we have to have a more desirable behavior. I couldn't at that moment say, I want to drink less just because it sounds good on paper. Because drinking, we just discussed all the benefits that drinking gave me. in order to release drinking, I have to have a new behavior. This non-drinking life has to carry more value for me. And that's a tough thing to create. It's like, okay, now I have to develop a healthy coping mechanism. Now I have to develop a way to process my pain. I've never done that. Now, you know, and then also devaluing drinking, like, actually, yes, it does relieve the pain, but it also ruins relationships. Also doesn't allow me to show up in an intimate way emotionally with friends or romantic partners. And so in that process, once you can find something, a new behavior that carries more value, you can release the old. But until you have that new behavior with the value, your brain will not be convinced. Your brain will not be able to release old behaviors based on affirmations alone. Affirmations are great. I don't want to poo-poo like the whole lifestyle of like, I just need to manifest it by affirming this 100 times. But your brain is not that easily fooled. Yeah. Your nervous system is not that easily fooled. It needs evidence. And so how do you get that evidence? You go out in the world, you do the personal work, you find good lab partners, as I say, get in the lab and work with someone who can show you that compassion, who can point out your blind spots, give you that feedback, that helpful feedback that may be hard to hear at times, and can be your well-wisher who says, hey, just because you have this closet of shame, I'm still here. I love you. I accept you. And my opinion of you has not changed.
Mm. If you've ever considered having a podcast, especially if you're expert at what you do, I cannot suggest more highly using Podigy's service, which is what we use. If you like this production here, I highly suggest you reach out to Podigy through their contact in the show notes below to run and host your podcast. I went through a bunch of different teams, tried a bunch of different things. No one came close to what I got post-production from Podigy. And even just making a launch easy, taking your content, sharing it, making it presentable, please check out Podigy. If you're great at what you do and you've ever considered having a podcast, I really am excited for you to try them out as well. So there's a level of acceptance that, so there's a feedback. You got to get some good feedback so you can see outside of your brain. This, I remember being a monk thinking I was so special. I was 18 years old, and I remember it was maybe 2 weeks into when I moved into living as a monk. And I was eating something. I just had some schmutz, some food here. And I just remember one of the monks kind of like, probably we were all underslept, unfortunately. He just kind of looked at me. He's like, he turned to me, shouted my name. And I remember going, what? Like, what? He's like, wipe your face. And I remember feeling so embarrassed. Like, oh my God, I thought he was going to criticize me. And so there's a way in which it's like having a desire to get that feedback is essential for, let's say, seeing what you can't see, like some rice or whatever I had on my face. And then I thought it's very fascinating this point you made, too. You can't just affirmation it away, shout it in the mirror and just hope it'll change. We're not so easy to, the brain is far more sensitive and developed than that. And so you have to create something that's more desirable. And I like this one quote. So oftentimes on this podcast, I like to quote the Bhagavad Gita. And there's a Sanskrit phrase in there, param drisva nivartante, which literally means in order to give up something lesser, you got to grab something better. Mm. You know, you got to drop something. If you have something in your hand, you got to drop it to create space to hold something better. And so I really appreciate this point that you're making is until you have something better, until there's a better habit, something to actually, instead of say numb the pain, to actually deal with the pain, mm-hmm. not just procrastinate feeling, all the emotions and experiences that you have to a later date, actually dealing with it. And so are there any particular behaviors, practices that you find once somebody's in this space where they're getting some feedback, they're introspecting, they're not just, how dare you? How dare you point out the schmutz on my face? Once that receptivity is there, what would you suggest are the ways to either find a proper partner for feedback, like friend, or like when I say partner, really just any other person for feedback, and or through the process of introspection, like on your own and in that meditation of identifying what your triggers are, what that facade, what that mask is, like how can we identify what behaviors would be beneficial to replace the numbing ones? Like you gave the example of drinking and gosh, there's a long list of ones right. I could personally give that I know very well about that cover the problem as opposed to actually dealing with it. Like what behaviors might be helpful to explore?
Well, it's going to be hard to change anything if your landscape hasn't changed. So if you look at the nature of the brain, it is geared towards entrainment. we're geared to attune to our surroundings. Now, this starts in childhood, back to childhood, where whatever your childhood was, you were going to attune to those surroundings. Because what are you going to do when you're 6 years old? Run away from home? No, you're not. You have no choice. You have no agency. And this is why for people who have lived a life of disempowerment, where they were punished for, you know, doing something innocuous, it was confusion. Why are you blaming me for this? Why are you criticizing me for this? Inevitably, children will bring it on themselves that it was their fault. So this lack of agency and lack of expressing needs and lack of feeling understood, it starts so early of thinking that you're the problem. So when you talk about, okay, now I'm going to stop getting angry, stop doing all my protective stuff. No, you're not. You're not going to stop that until you start to find an experience of belonging with someone. It could start with one person. It can start with a group of people that you find. And when I say community, it can be family. It can be a church. It can be your job. It can be a political, whatever group that you're involved in. Finding something where you're a part of something bigger than yourself, big key to happiness, where there's a reason why you wake up in the morning, where you're not alone. We're communal beings. We need to belong. And this dates back to earlier civilizations, where if you were excommunicated or, you know, outcast from the community, you would literally die because now you don't have shared resources. And that follows with us today, even though our society has obviously changed. So first of all, you need to find some sense of belonging. Now, this is tricky because if you find your sense of belonging with people who are pursuing things that are not really in your value system, such as if I, well, this is what I was doing, was hanging out with other drinkers. What am I going to do? Start hanging out with a non-drinker? It has to be very appealing. Like, why would I do that? So your association is everything. Mm. Because you will attune to it. And if you hang out with people who do not align with your values, you will naturally attune to those people and be aligned with your values. So it's twofold. What do you want in life? What drives you? What are your values? And now take a look at who you're associating with. Do those things match? And if there's a mismatch, or if you don't know what your values are, that's another question.
If you don't know, well, you're going to get them anyway, kind of, yeah. Like I often say, whether you study psychology or not, you got one. Whether you study philosophy or not, you got one. So even if you don't know your values, you're going to start to pick them up. I can't remember who it was, but they said, show me your friends, I'll show you your future.
Yeah.
You're so influenced by our environment, arguably the biggest part of our environment being our association, the people we're surrounded by. So creating a sense of belonging with like-minded individuals that say either have aligned values or have the values you want to acquire in life.
Yeah.
Is, say, a practical way, essential. I might go so big based off what you're sharing. Honestly, based on what I've understood and experiences, it's an essential aspect of, let's say, the growth we're looking for with overcoming some of these default mechanisms, becoming conscious of them and working through them. And I think maybe just a quick aside there that I'd be very curious to pick your brain with. Two masters, you said, right? So the first one was in spiritual
psychology.
Spiritual psychology. And the second one?
Clinical mental health.
That's so cool. I've learned through without going so deep into it, I've learned that, so we have the subconscious mind and the conscious mind, which in simple, subconscious mind, which functions, it gets trained, and it functions on its own as almost a default. You get into the car after you drive enough times and you just know what to do with the gas pedal. You just know what to do with the brake, how to turn, et cetera. You don't have to think about brushing your tooth. You just do it. And the conscious mind, which is more of the center of deliberation of bring your awareness where you can actually make discerning decisions per se. And my understanding is that up until about the age 7, we're really just a sponge. Your subconscious mind is being trained. Like you mentioned that you don't really have much agency. You have to learn how to survive, make do, you adjust to the environment. And then from 8 to 25, or somewhere in that ballpark, that's where you say develop your own personality mm-hmm. based around that information that you took through your senses, what you saw, heard, what you say consumed around you through all your senses. And so someone might then say the argument, oh, you know what, Kim, this is really practical. I hear what you're saying. And like, but this is just who I am. This is just who I am. Like, I didn't really have a choice. This is how I was. This is how my parents trained me to be. This is how the people who raised me trained me to be. You know, did I even have a choice? You expect me to what? Change my family? I can't change my family. How do I change my association? Now, obviously, I'm being a little tongue in cheek with it, but one might easily push back. And I say this because I know I push back a lot. Rebellious does not cut what I experienced. That word does not touch on quite the extent of what I felt as a teenager. but someone who was like me, or is like me, I should say. And I say, yeah, right. Like, you expect me to change everything? Like, good luck. What am I, spend 5 lifetimes doing this? What advice would you give for somebody who feels that it's just so difficult, it's so hard? How am I going to find my people? How am I going to find my tribe? How am I actually going to get feedback from somebody who doesn't have bad intentions, who's actually not going to hurt me, that I don't actually have to put my walls or facade up for? How would you help someone wrestle or reconcile with those experiences, those negative thought patterns, we might call them?
The fact that that person would even ask that question lets me know that they have an issue with it. When I talk to people, it's not my job to tell you what an issue is in your life. It's your job to tell me if you have an issue with drinking, if you have an issue with your anger. And if someone is telling me that their life is unfulfilling, that they struggle with emotional regulation and they feel hopeless, there's nothing wrong with feeling hopeless. But the fact that they're disturbed by the fact that they feel hopeless, they're disturbed by the fact that they have anger, tells me that they want to be in a different place. So now we have the desire, and the desire is all you need to begin. When it comes to changing behaviors, what will help you a lot is, like I said earlier, if you don't have a good sense of self and who you are as a person, you're open to manipulation, to becoming involved with a group of people who will say, no, this isn't how you are. This is how you are. And here, you need to do this and this. And then all of a sudden you're, you know, down this path of, what am I doing? So it's important to at least do some introspection of what is important to you. What you can tell is what brings you joy in life. You have a lot of data, whoever you are, even if you've never spent an hour in therapy, you have a lot of data to pull from your life of, when are times that you have felt close to people? When are times when you felt understood? Times that have been most gutting to you? Why was it so gutting? What specifically was going on? When people come to me, they'll say, like couples, number one goal is we want to improve communication. That tells me nothing. What communication means is, you know, one person might mean, well, the way they communicate is when we have an argument, they shut down and they withdraw, and then I don't see them for 3 days. Well, our communication issues is they get really expressive. They criticize. They do this. They're never happy. I don't know what to do. I feel like a failure, and blah, blah, blah. So we have to get specific in life and really introspective. And once again, people don't like to sit with themselves because it's uncomfortable. But when you can sit with yourself with compassionate curiosity and say, oh, I understand why I did this. Okay, then you're going to start seeking people who now align with your views. If you have the self-image that you are too much, you're too emotional, you're hopeless, you're this or that, you're not going to be you have a lens now at which you look at the world. And as you go through the world, you're going to find people who confirm that bias. It's like, oh, you speak my language. Oh, yeah, I am hopeless. Why do people who suffered a lot of volatility and perhaps abuse in childhood, for at least the first few relationships, seek out partners who then recreate that experience? It's not because they want abuse. It's not because they want to recreate that. It's what's familiar. It's what their lens is. I deserve this. It's never been any different. Why should I seek something that's different? And we just naturally align with these old belief patterns and patterns that confirm this idea of who we are that just leaves us in these cycles of hopelessness. So, you know, being able to understand what's made you happy in life, maybe you have to go all the way back to childhood to say, like, well, the last time I was happy was when I was drawing as a kid, or when I was outside hiking, you know, playing, who knows what it is. But childhood holds a lot of answers for happiness as well. That's what drives you, what makes you want to get up in the morning.
That's interesting, because sometimes, I would say oftentimes people take the approach, usually when they think, oh, go back to your childhood, it's like, oh, so I got to feel those uncomfortable feelings again. But I think it's such a beautiful point you made. Actually, going back there, there's happiness available. There's a lot of, it's not just negative emotions, but all emotions are available there in a very pure form. And I love this, as you said, it's so concisely. It's compassionate curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
What a perfect term to give that. Like, yeah. Compassionate curiosity. Not necessarily judging, just acknowledging, like trying to assess the situation, collect that data, put it all together in such a way that it starts to make sense, starts to give some semblance of sense, at least, and
yeah,
starting with the desire there. I think that's a profound point, because otherwise it could feel, as you mentioned, like hopeless or whatever the case may be. It's like, nah, just start with this desire.
Yeah.
And then that brain will find evidence for whatever you believe anyway.
Yes, it will. So yeah. Yeah. And this whole idea that you can't change, science has proven that idea wrong. And it's called neuroplasticity. Now, neuroplasticity means that the brain can create new pathways. You can learn different ways of thinking about the world. You know, the essence of cognitive behavioral therapy is there's a cognitive piece, how you perceive the world, how you perceive you, yourself, the other person. That determines how you feel about them. That determines your behaviors towards them. There's so much gold in understanding what your perspectives in life are. And the healing comes from being able to reframe it. Like, am I just a hopeless alcoholic who just can't handle life, you know, and that I have the feelings and the behaviors from that? Am I someone who's looking to release a lot of pain? Am I looking to be understood in my pain? Am I still lovable despite being abandoned and given up? That's the root of all these questions. So, you know, when it comes to like, I'll never change, you're wrong. Science has proven that you're wrong. You can change at any moment. What you need is a support system and people to believe in you. People do not like going back to childhood, just as an aside note. They don't like going back to childhood because it's just, it's so, back to the house of cards. My parents love me. They would never do anything to harm me. What are you saying? Don't insult my parents. Mm. And they can't even touch on what happened in childhood. Where if you can learn to hold two, we'll call them competing feelings at the same time. Number one, I love and respect and have a great amount of gratitude for my parents for everything they did for me. They are a product of their childhoods. They did the best that they can. And I appreciate them for that. And there were some things that happened that caused me a lot of pain, that set me on a difficult path. And these are things that I'm navigating. And I'm not blaming my parents. It's just this, I love my parents. And I had some emotional reactions and feelings as a result of my childhood. When you can hold those two things, then you can take an honest look at what is your childhood? Because it boggles my mind. I understand why people don't want to talk about childhood. I'm fine. I'm over it. I've moved on. It's not important. So you're telling me that you wake up today, let's say I'll go back to myself. I wake up at 53 years old and let's pretend like, let's say I wake up at 30 years old and I'm angry. I'm hungover. My life is not great. Out of yet another volatile relationship, or at least a non-intimate, I've never really been in volatile relationships, but very like closed off relationships. And yeah, at 30 years old, it's not necessary to understand the origin of where I came from. I don't need to go there. I just need to like fix what I am now.
Deal with it today.
Yeah, I just white knuckle it.
Yeah.
Just fix it. Whereas the only way you can have compassionate, you know, understanding for yourself is to say, oh, these things happened. You don't have to drown in childhood when you talk about childhood, but to at least have the understanding that these things, you put the pieces together. Mm. There's now a method to your madness. Now there's a reason why, oh, I see why I'm protective. I see why I've longed to have this sort of understanding. It helps you invite more curiosity, invite more compassion to your current life. If you can just touch on the building blocks of who you are as a person.
Well, I find like hearing you say this, I'm like, yeah. I'm like, yeah. And I'm reminded by the significance of, say, accountability and support. And it's not impossible to do things on our own.
Correct.
But it's very difficult.
That's right.
It's not the quick route to success. It's trying to recreate the wheel. And I don't think you'll mind me sharing this, but I know you have services that help people with this. And everyone listening knows I have no interest in ever suggesting something I myself would get behind. It's just, we don't accept ads or sponsors or anything. I just talk about the things I actually like. And you are someone, I mean, the first place that I wanted to have this conversation with, because you're someone who I've met people who you've actually helped. What's big of you? You're just so brilliant. And I love conversing with you. For people who are looking for help, support, guidance with these matters, I know that you support them in different ways. What's the best way for people to learn what you have to offer, how you can help them do everything that we're talking about in like a very practical and supported way?
Well, I thank you, by the way. That was very appreciative. We live in a wonderful age of technology. Now, this technology can also be the bane of our existence when it comes to social media. But if you look at the positives, we have so much access to help, so much affordable access. You know, I'm moving more away from private sessions and more towards larger group offerings because it's more affordable. you know, my cohort, to the cost of one of my cohorts is comparable to one private session with me. So making things accessible to people. I have a book that'll be coming out in a year. That's what, $20. Don't buy my book. If you don't like me, great. There are other books out there. There are free YouTube videos out there. There's social media. People have told me, I get messages every day about how I have made a difference in people's lives just off a 90-second reel. I have trouble believing it. But when people are in a certain space and they consider a concept of, let's say, compassionate curiosity for the first time in their life, and it creates a huge shift, that's life-changing. And if it can be done in 90 seconds, great. Don't ever sign up for one of my, you know, whatever you can glean. There are resources out there that are very affordable. So in this day and age, I just have trouble accepting that, well, therapy is too expensive. I can't do it. Find a resource in your price range, and they're out there. Books, podcasts, your podcasts, many podcasts available that talk about relationships, mental health. You'll find relatability, group work. If you find a group coaching, group therapy, where the price is usually $20 to $30 for one session, not hundreds of dollars. It's out there and it's accessible. So for people, get on YouTube, get on ChatGPT, get out there. There is information to help you. And, you know, in the world of AI, it's wonderful that, yes, you can plug questions into ChatGPT and find some brilliant insight as to your childhood. You don't need me, actually. But what you do need, ultimately, is you need some healing in relationship. You mentioned this earlier, where we're harmed in relationship and we need to heal in relationship. It'll be that missing piece of, yes, I can feel understood by ChatGPT. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, a series of ones and zeros, and it's a machine. What will help my heart is because it's in my DNA to be connected to another human being. What will help my heart is to have another human being who has free will choice, which is scary, because with that free will choice, they can reject me. They can do a lot of things with this free will choice. But what is most rewarding about love when there's free will choice is that they can choose to accept me with all my flaws, all my shame, and they can choose to support me and hear me and understand me. And it's not because I plugged a question into the computer and they're doing it of their own free will. Do not underestimate. That is what human interaction comes with, is this aspect of free will choice that makes it well beyond the reward that you can get from an AI companion.
Social mammals.
That's right.
Whether we like it or not.
I know. I went kicking and screaming for years, like, I don't need people.
Yeah.
But I do.
And it's just becoming self-accepting. Going back to the point you made, it's just like accepting reality for what it is.
Yes.
This is the pretty stuff to look at. This is stuff, okay, it's not as pretty, but it's there. And so let's deal with it and let's get some help dealing with it from like-minded people, ideally, and finding some option that's accessible. I'm so excited speaking with you. Every conversation that we have, you're just such a wealth of knowledge. And I hope you know how much myself, and certainly on behalf of everyone listening to this, they'll agree that it's sort of like a relief is the word I want to use, like such a relief to have resources like what you provide, because as we've alluded to, 100% of humans could benefit from improving the quality of their relationship.
Yes.
So thank you for the amount of lives that you've shared, many of which I've met. Thank you for having these kinds of powerful conversations where all it takes is just one little point to just hit the heart, hit the mind and change and say, yes, you know what? I have enough of a desire to start to move in the right direction, to start to make that connection, and you make it available and accessible. And for that, I'm really grateful.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm grateful to be in your association. And thank you for giving me a voice with this platform to get the message out there that people, you're empowered to make different choices. You know, Viktor Frankl, one of my favorite quotes of Viktor Frankl is, you know, that between stimulus and response, there's a space. Mm. And so the reason why emotional regulation, that these cohorts of mine are so popular, is because the secret to healing is not that you never get triggered. For the rest of my life, I will be triggered by abandonment. Whenever someone hurts my feelings, my immediate reaction will be, I don't need you. I'm going to go over here and screw this. That's my immediate reaction. It will be with me until I die. That's the stimulus. But there's a space. And in that space, I can choose what to do with that trigger. And that is healing. Healing is not that you never get triggered. Healing is what you do with that trigger and how you respond to it. So, you know, just that perspective alone, our suffering comes from our perspective in the world. And if you have a perspective where life should be smooth 100% of the time, I should never fight with my spouse, otherwise my marriage is horrible. You will suffer in life. This is the power of cognitive behavioral thinking, is what is your perspective? How can you reframe it? And it can create huge shifts in your life.
I just want to encapsulate what you said and just play it every day. And the cool things I can on this podcast, because that really, that's like, that defines what we're talking about when we say conscious success. It's becoming conscious.
Yes.
Acknowledging that space between the stimuli and response, and consciously choosing how you want to react or respond to it. And so, Kim, I'm so grateful for your time. I know you won't push it, but I think people should sign up for your stuff, because I just know how beneficial it is. And certainly everyone start with what's available to them. You know, everyone has a choice, has an option. My suggestion is finding something and someone that you are willing to trust. And I know that I'm willing to trust you, which I extend the trust into everyone else as well. I really encourage everyone to at least check out your resources, which you'll be able to find at the link in the bio below. Start to consume it. Go to your website and start to check out some of the resources there. You've got a lot of free, amazingly helpful content as well. And definitely peek at the cohorts if you haven't already. Check out Kim's content. And as always, if you enjoy the type of content that we explore on this podcast, feel free to join our Conscious Success community, where we give away all these knowledge and tools and resources for free for anyone to enjoy and benefit and improve the quality of their life from. And all we ever ask is that you take anything that helps you and share that with at least one other person so that you can improve their quality of life as well. Thank you again, Kim, for your time. And I can't wait to keep this conversation going another time.
Thank you, Mara.